Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
Yes, there are praying mantis blues. This song's a little reliant on a praying mantis. I would say stereotype. It isn't something that they don't ever do. But it barely tells the story of them. We're going to try to tell the story of praying mantises today. I should say two things. One is that our occasion for doing this is the praying mantis, as any patriotic Connecticut citizen knows, is our state insect. But there are some school children, some well-meaning school children, who have suggested that maybe something else would be a better state insect. I'm open to that argument, but not really. And then the other thing I want to say, and I've never said this before in our long tenure of working together, but I think that senior producer Lily Tyson, who is the producer of this particular episode, is a little bit prejudiced against praying mantises. Like, for example, I'll just read to you. I don't ever do this, but I'll read to you from our notes. She mentions in the notes that about the school children and stuff. Then she goes, "What we uncovered was a terrifying, aggressive, highly effective predator," which I don't know. It seems a little loaded here. But I'm very pro praying mantis. And with me is somebody else who I think probably within, you know, the parameters of scientific investigation is too. That would be Catherine Dugas, entomologist and research technician at the Connecticut Agriculture Experiment Station. She has brought some praying mantises to the studio with her. They are not alive because it's the wrong time of year. But it's exciting to have you here. So, well, let's begin with this whole terrifying, aggressive, highly effective predator image. It's not wrong.
No, it's not. These are very good at what they do, which is to catch anything smaller than them and
eat it.
And eat it, yeah.
And it seems like praying mantises never say, "You know what? I'm full. No. I'm good. I don't need anything today."
No, they're always hungry.
Yeah, they're wanting to eat. But when you watch them do what they do, it is pretty amazing, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, first of all, I don't think there's another insect that can swivel its head and look at you. But I mean, beyond that, they have this kind of kung fu, crouching tiger, hidden dragon thing where they can just do all kinds of acrobatics and sneaky stuff, right? They're cunning in their own way.
Oh, absolutely. You know, they do what they do by not moving, by not being seen. And that's beneficial, obviously, because there are things bigger than them that would also eat them. You know, they're not really good at stalking. I mean, they can very slowly, but generally the way that they are going to eat is by being as unobtrusive as possible. And that can involve standing still for hours in a field. They'll even sway if they feel wind to basically mimic the grass and the vegetation around them.
Come on,
and
now that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
that's pretty impressive.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they'll lie in wait, and the moment something unsuspectingly crosses their path, I mean, boom! It's faster than we can perceive. It is absolutely lightning fast.
Yeah, they are skilled jumpers too, who seem to be able to kind of, first of all, they seem to be able to triangulate to where they need to go. Mm-hmm. But they also seem to be able to look at a prey, like a fly or something, mm-hmm. that's moving sort of in non-specific patterns and still somehow or other know where the fly is going to be by the time they get over there.
Yeah, they have amazing eyesight, amazing visual acuity. So insect eyes are compound. You know, we have two eyes. They can have hundreds of eyes that all work together, kind of like pixels in a graphic image. And each little photoreceptor, or omatidia, to use the right term, is a pixel. And if you look at a mantis's eye, it looks like glass to naked eye. And then if you zoom in on, you know, in a macro lens or microscope, you can see those individual photoreceptors, which are all working together to create this incredibly high resolution image of the insect's world. And if you look at the shape of the eye, it's round, and they can see behind them. They can see in front. And then, like you mentioned, they have that that ability to swivel their head.
Mm.
And so they can turn and look.
Yeah.
And they do. You know, that's one thing people find really fascinating about them is, you know, most of the time you see an insect and it just seems to be mindlessly or just completely unaware of the bigger animals around it. Mantids, not so much. You know, they look at you and you look at them and you're having a moment.
I think you might have said at the beginning they'll eat anything smaller than they are, but mm-hmm. they'll eat things that are maybe a little bit bigger than they are too, including, I mean, I think the biggest strike against them, besides not being a native species, they do eat hummingbirds and people like hummingbirds.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, like everything that's sensational, you know, that tends to be what gets boosted.
Right.
It does happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're not seeing a hummingbird being eaten every day in your garden.
Hmm.
That would be a little terrifying, actually.
And they will eat other birds, although my sense is they move up into the weight classes of birds. Then you get it. There's a sort of a gray area where sometimes the mantis gets you, sometimes you get the mantis.
Yes.
I mean, they pick on the wrong bird, they're going to get eaten.
Yeah. So, you know, they give as good as they get, I guess.
Yeah. So maybe we say a little bit about what they're doing here. They weren't, I don't think, or are any mantises native to North America?
Not this far north, no.
Yeah.
The European or praying mantis, it's the official state insect. The first time it was found in Connecticut was in the 1950s, and then it got designated as the state insect in the 70s, late 70s. The Chinese mantis, which is the one that I think is probably more familiar to people, that's the big one. That's the one that can be about 4 to 5 inches in the fall. That one was initially accidentally introduced, plant material imported. Mm. And then people said, hey, these things are pretty cool. So they started importing them purposefully as a biological control for their gardens. You know, you can let an egg case loose in the spring. They hatch. You have hundreds of little baby mantids. They're very cute. They just look like miniaturized adults. And they will distribute themselves into that that environment, and they'll grow. Most of them don't make it, usually about one or two out of any particular ootheca, which is the official term for the egg case, will survive to adulthood.
Yeah, I want to come back to that for a second. We should say also, this is probably, you have to be a little bit more of an entomology nerd to care about this, but when they come out of their egg case, they kind of look like a praying mantis. They're not larval or a pupa or any of that stuff. You have a nymph that looks pretty much like a kind of a soft praying mantis.
Yeah, yeah. They don't have the wings yet. That's more of an adult trait. But they have what's called gradual metamorphosis. So they don't have a pupal stage, you know, like you think of a butterfly, starts as a caterpillar, becomes pupal or chrysalis, and then becomes an adult. These guys look like praying mantises or mantids, you know, tomato, tomato there, from the start. They're very recognizable.
Yeah. And they also molt, right? They the hard shell on the outside, it doesn't fit. They slip it off. They
right,
grow a new
right.
One?
Yeah. So they basically, that exoskeleton doesn't grow with them. Their insides do. And then once the insides get too big for the exoskeleton, they pop right out of their skin. And then they're in the next instar, you know, the next stage of development. And depending on the species, that can be anywhere from 5 to 8 or 9 times before they finish their final molt. And then when they're an adult, that's done. They're done. They no longer grow.
It's like a kid. You just have to keep buying them new clothes until they stop growing.
Yep.
So I'm going to take just a second to read something from Rachel Carson, who's enjoying a little bit of a revival with the release of Three Body Problem. But she writes, "The trouble is that we are seldom aware of the protection afforded by the natural enemies until it fails. Most of us walk unseeing through the world, unaware alike of its beauties, its wonders, and the strange and sometimes terrible intensity of the lives that are being lived about us. So it is that the activities of the insect predators and parasites are known to few. Perhaps we may have noticed an oddly shaped insect of ferocious mien on a bush in the garden and been dimly aware that the praying mantis lives at the expense of other insects." And so, yeah, they are, you know, integrated pest management. They're sort of that. In fact, I think Connecticut has, courtesy of Chris Rowland's character called Izzy, who's like a praying mantis, who's a puppet or something, is the symbol of integrated pest management. But that's a little bit of a double-edged sword, too, because they eat pollinators, right? They'll eat butterflies, they'll eat bumblebees. So it's not entirely 100% in the plus column.
Right. Yeah. They eat everything smaller than them, and honeybees are smaller than them.
Oh, well, so Lily Tyson wants me to have you describe the egg case more for our listeners and mention that you might even see them on Christmas trees.
Right. Yeah. So the egg case, it kind of looks like a melted marshmallow, like somebody had a campfire, melted a marshmallow, and then instead of eating it, just decided to slap it on the nearest branch. Well, I've done work in Christmas tree farms, these praying mantises love Christmas tree farms. It's just a great little habitat for them. And in the fall, the female, she only lays one ootheca, but she'll deposit that egg case. It's foamy, it's soft at first, and then it dries into kind of a more supportive foam. And then she's done. She won't survive the winter, but that egg case will remain there for the winter. Now, of course, a lot of Christmas trees get harvested and brought into homes. And so in certain cases, that egg case also makes its way indoors. And people who are lucky enough to find one, they've given us a call at the experiment station because now they want to know what to do with this thing. And our advice is to trim the twig that it's on. Bring it outside, tie it to a low bush or shrub nearby, and let it be. You don't want that sitting indoors for too long because they'll get tricked into thinking it's spring, and you will have hundreds of these little mantids running around your living room.
Right, and then they'll get big and eat your chihuahua.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're skipping over one thing. It was right there in that blues song that we played at the beginning. So part of their reputation is that whole idea that when the female has what she wants from the male, she bites off the male's head. Mm-hmm. So how 100% true is that?
50-50, let's say.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in his best interest to get away, obviously. because, well, first of all, doesn't want to lose his head. Second of all, if he gets away, that means he survives to mate again.
Mm-hmm.
And if he escapes again, he survives to potentially mate yet again. So the more times he's able to successfully mate, the more of his DNA is going to be spread.
Which also, in turn, just to remind people of Darwinianism, that means that evolution favors that kind of male, too.
Right.
That kind of male who's able to pass his genes on to multiple different mates. There's going to be more praying mantises around, male praying mantises, who are good at escaping.
Yeah, good crafty gentlemen.
But they are kind of generally cannibalistic, too, as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's in her best interest to eat him, you know, so she's going to try because, you know, he's a big meal.
Right.
And now she's got hundreds of little eggs developing in her. And so she needs a lot of protein. She needs a lot of energy. So, you know, he's right there. So, you know, it's very convenient. All in one package.
Lily Tyson has a lot of questions about this, but let me see if I mean, one of the reasons that it's in her best interest to eat the meal, you just said it, but it's one thing you know if you're a praying mantis and you're eating another praying mantis is you're getting all the nutrients it takes to make a praying mantis because you're eating a praying mantis. So think about it that way.
All the parts are right there.
Yeah, it's not like you have to take a multivitamin afterwards. You know, you got it all. So you know, I can tell though that you, like me, you like these animals, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I feel like we need to, I mean, what we just said, they're cannibalistic, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, that, first of all, how common is that in the insect world?
I mean, if you have something that's like carnivorous,
yeah.
I mean, I think it's a, it's when it's they're opportunistic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, and some aren't necessarily cannibalistic as much as they're scavengers.
Yeah.
And, you know, if, you know, for example, a lot of cockroaches, you know, they eat each other. They're not predating on each other. You know, they're not actively killing and eating each other. But, you know, if one dies, waste not.
I think people want nature to be nicer.
Yeah.
Than it is. And they see the hawk soaring in the sky and they don't want to think about how many rabbits that hawk had to eat.
Or cats.
Or cats or whatever, yes. So, and I think praying mantis suffer especially from that because, I don't know, maybe people don't see them any other way. People don't get to see them do the other stuff about them. I think if you watch a slow motion video of them hunting, you think, wow, this is a pretty cool animal. But mostly I think people think they're scary and gross.
Yeah. I mean, insects kind of have a bit of an uphill climb when it comes to charisma, you know, and mantids are one of those more charismatic. So considering how negative some people see them. They're not honeybees, you know, they're not bumblebees, you know, they're not butterflies, you know, they're not cute or pretty, in the conventional sense, but, they are animals. You know, that's something I run into a lot is, you know, people don't necessarily read them as animals, because, you know, animals are vertebrates to a lot of people. I think the head turning, the you can anthropomorphize that, you know, it's looking at you. And I think that kind of endears people to them on some level.
It depends.
Yeah.
You know, you looking at me, why are you looking at me right now? But yeah, they're not going to become vegans.
No.
They're just sort of not.
It's not their thing.
But the other thing, people do like them because they're kind of, there's a kind of an anthropomorphous quality to them. They got kind of what looks like arms, legs, neck, head. And so they're large for an insect. So they're kind of attractive to people as pets or to have them.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, any particular thoughts about whether you should be keeping one as a pet?
I mean, it's kind of like having tropical fish. You know, it's all a matter of taste. I mean, our office, we have a big tank full of Madagascar hissing cockroaches, which,
by the way, cockroaches and praying mantises, that's like the last evolutionary fork in the road for the mantises, right?
Right? Yeah, they share a common ancestor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And cockroaches, you know, when people think of cockroaches, you know, this is a house pest. This is something that's disgusting. And I think there's a little bit of that reaction when people walk into our office. But there's also a lot of reaction of, oh, what are those? Those are cool. Because they're behind glass. These are tropical roaches. They don't have wings. They're pretty content to just sit still. And people then get a good look at them. And because there's kind of that barrier, I think it makes people appreciate them a little more.
Right. So the in terms of keeping them as a pet, one thing that we have to caution you about is it's not going to be a long relationship.
No. Well, not with this species, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The praying mantis is, what, going to live 10 months, something like that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a big insect, but it has a very short lifespan from what you'd expect.
And I just want to point out, this might be the one praying mantis fact that you don't know, or there may be no praying mantis facts that you don't know. But back in 2016, I think, the Kansas City Royals had a praying mantis who turned up, I think, in their dugout. And then he got on one of the players' hats. I think it was Billy Burns. And they got really attached to him. They called him or it or her the rally mantis. And the rally mantis stuck around pretty much for the entire season. And everybody in Kansas City knew about the rally mantis. The idea was good luck. And the Royals were playing a little better with the mantis around. I think it might have even gone on a road trip to Minnesota with them. But, you know, I mean, it's so Kansas City, really good press for the mantis. And when the mantis died in November, they put out a press statement saying, you know, announcing the passing of the rally mantis. But see, you just need a few breaks like that, I think. You need some branding opportunities.
Absolutely.
If you're a praying mantis. All right. So meanwhile, we are, Lily Tyson has just suggested another question, which is, if you have them as pets, do you have to go catch bugs for them, or will they just sort of take care of that
I mean, unless you're letting things into your house and then letting them into the cage, you're kind of having to do the grocery shopping a little bit.
Yeah.
The times we've had a mantis on staff, I don't know, maybe as a consultant, living in a little tank or a jar or whatever until we can relocate it. You have to catch food for it. House flies.
Does it want something alive?
Generally, it needs to be moving for them to kind of register it as food. Maybe if you put like dog food on a tip of a pencil and kind of teased it a little bit, you might get it to nibble. But it really does better on its natural food.
Right. And if you have like one of those little teacup poodles or something, don't have the brain.
Oh, no.
You never know.
Yeah, it'll disappear.
Yeah. All right. So we'll take a little break. We're here. We'll come back. We'll talk a little bit, too, about the mantises. They're not endangered as a species, but they might be endangered as a state insect. We'll explain more.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygenating it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed, and in our center, with a special ECMO on the go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to heart for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
So we've been talking about praying mantises. We will continue to do that very thing, although we're going to expand a little bit and talk about pretenders to the throne of the praying mantis here in Connecticut with Catherine Dugas, entomologist and research technician at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm sort of a Connecticut nerd, so if you had asked me what the state insect was, I didn't need any preparation for that. I know it's the praying mantis. But there are some school children, some lovely, nice school children, who wonder whether this is the best choice, partly because of something we said before. They're not really from here. But, you know, I don't know, in the time of the world, they've been here a long time now. So explain what's happening here. What are the counter offers or the counter proposals to the mantis?
So there's been two. So one is the spring azure butterfly. This is a very early emerging species. We're talking imminently arriving, in a couple of weeks. But this is a small butterfly. It's only got about an inch wingspan.
I'm guessing it's blue.
It's blue, yeah. And it's an early season pollinator. Things like blueberry, for example. And then the caterpillars feed on dogwood, the flowers and the fruits. So this is an early season butterfly. So they kind of get their business done pretty much before summer's even started.
And we can't like dig up any dirt on them. They don't like get together and murder something else.
No, not really. They do employ ants to protect them. So this is the caterpillars can actually secrete a substance that attracts ants, and the ants find it tasty, and they find this caterpillar to be a food source worth protecting. So the ants will actually guard these caterpillars and prevent them from being predated.
Wait a second. Are these ants being adequately compensated?
I think maybe I'm
going to have my research people look into this. I think we can dig up some dirt on these on these butterflies. Okay, what's the other one?
So it's a species of dragonfly called the autumn meadowhawk, and it's a little red dragonfly. Dragonflies are pretty recognizable to most people. It's a pretty diverse group of very ancient insects.
Mm-hmm.
When you talking lineages, we're going back hundreds of millions of years.
Do they do anything? Do they pollinators? Do they contribute anything to society? I'm sorry for my tone of voice.
Yeah. Well, no, they're also predators. They're hunters. They're aerial hunters, though. So, they're going to get things that are on the wing. And that includes mosquitoes. And they are aquatic. So the nymphs, again, this is an ancient species, so they don't have that complex metamorphosis as modern insects do. But the youngsters are aquatic, and so are mosquito larvae. So they are eating mosquito larvae. So they're helping prevent future mosquitoes.
We should just pause from talking about praying mantises and just say, at least I will say, I have at least one neighbor, maybe more, who have those bug zappers. And I always say, meh, meh. I'm thinking, you're not just killing mosquitoes. You're probably killing things that eat mosquitoes. You're killing all kinds of things. Maybe not a great idea for,
Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends how it's attracting them. I mean, it's probably mostly the light. So, yeah, you're probably getting a few moths in there as well.
On our show a few months ago or whenever it was, we were doing a show about charisma. And the final episode, the final segment was about charismatic megafauna. Praying mantises are kind of charismatic minor fauna. I mean, they're little, but you have already used the word once or twice, right? There's something charismatic about this animal.
Right, yeah. I'd agree.
Yeah, I mean, it's way more interesting than a butterfly. A butterfly's not going to do that. Yeah. Right? We should say the students, the Azure butterfly students are at Watkinson School in Hartford, which I have a longstanding relationship, and the students at Center Road School in Vernon are the people arguing for the autumn meadowlark dragonfly, and that the lawmakers have, it's just too big an issue to tackle this session. I mean, they're going to need to convene a study panel, and so it's not going to happen this year.
No.
But I think, I will just contribute one thing to this conversation, which is that the praying mantis, because it is the state insect, has been the state insect, it has been on people's minds a lot over the years. And so the Hartford Yard Goats, the baseball team in Hartford, were almost the praying mantises. That was one of the finalist names. And in 2017, they did this kind of alternate universe night where they showed people what it would have looked like if they had been the praying mantises. And they took the field as the praying mantises. They had different uniforms. I think there were a limited issue. There were like 2,000 fans got a praying mantis cap that night. I really want that cap.
Same.
Yeah, I mean, we really want it. To my mind, that would have actually been a better name. I looked around for a minor league baseball team called the Praying Mantises. There doesn't seem to be one, but that would have been a great name.
I think so.
Yeah. And they need any help they can get. So the Praying Mantis also, we're going to talk a little bit about the Praying Mantis in culture. It plays into some other stereotypes. And the femme fatale, the idea, you heard it in that song we opened the show with, the idea that when they're done with you, they bite your head off. That's kind of a tripwire or something, right? I mean, in the sense that people look at that and they go, oh, yeah, that's like in some noir movie where the woman is really attractive and then she kills the guy who went after her.
Yeah. And there's some, like we said before, there is some truth to that. But, a lot of it's just nature doing what nature does. And there are other stereotypes you could lean into. The word mantis itself is Greek root. It means soothsayer. And what it's probably describing is, insects have three pairs of legs.
Mm.
The mantis generally only stands on four of those legs. And then the other two are modified in what we call raptorial forelegs. And that means they're for grabbing.
Yeah.
But when the mantis is not grabbing, when it's ready, those two little forelegs kind of are pressed together, kind of like they're in prayer.
Yeah.
And the Greek word for soothsayer is a direct reflection of that. the mantis.
This is probably something that I would not expect you to know, but there is a Marvel Comics character present in Guardians of the Galaxy known as Mantis. She is an empath. Mm-hmm. I don't think she's much of a praying mantis, but she does have like little antennae that stick up on everything. But I mean, you know, all joking aside, popular culture depictions of things are helpful or harmful, depending on how they come out. I'll also point out, this is courtesy of Lily Tyson, that, because I'd forgotten about this, but in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, there was a villain called She Mantis. But we should also talk about Manny, okay? In A Bug's Life, we just heard the theme at the beginning of this segment for A Bug's Life. There is a mantis named Manny, who is, I believe, a magician?
Right, yeah. And that's absolutely leaning into that soothsayer stereotype. He's very theatrical, and he's constantly, he's doing sleight of hand and mind reading, if I'm not mistaken, as well. And yeah, so I like that because it's clever. You know, it's looking at the etymology that's different than entomology. It's looking at the root of the word and, you know, why are we calling it a praying mantis? And so it is, in fact, praying with an A, not praying with an E, though I have seen both spellings.
I've seen both spellings, yeah, as well. And when something like that happens, this is a more kind of entertaining, less ferocious and terrifying depiction of a praying mantis. It is helpful. Mm-hmm. I was on TikTok today, and there are a lot of TikToks of young people with a praying mantis that they've found who's playing on their hand or something, or hopping or walking around up on their head or something. But inevitably, it's hashtag Manny. And you just realize, some mantises are probably not getting squished or hurled away or something, because suddenly you have some source of, you know, however improbable and unscientific, affection for them.
Yeah.
So if you like an animal, you hope it gets depicted in a Pixar film or something like that.
Definitely.
There's also, because of how humanoid they are, I mean, we don't have three pairs of legs, but otherwise, and we don't have wings, but otherwise, they're pretty humanoid. And so you kind of see them in lots and lots of different places. And one thing that we had looked into at one point is that there does appear to be some kind of style of martial arts that involves maybe praying mantis positions or something.
Right. Yeah. It's mantis style. Now, I'm not an expert in martial arts. I'm an expert in insects. But the reflection of the movement of the mantis is, I believe, the kind of the core of that that field. And, a mantis doesn't move unless it really needs to, when it's getting ready to strike. And if I'm not mistaken, that style also reflects that with very efficient strikes.
Yeah, an economy of movement.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the praying mantis has an advantage that we don't have, no matter what martial art we learn, which is they're really kind of hard to see. I mean, I was just watching a video of, I think, an entomologist walking through a soybean field. And he knew kind of how to look for them. But boy, otherwise, you could just be pulling aside, soybean leaves all day long and not be able to find them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've found that myself. I'm not that I'm actively looking for them all the time. But the times that we run into them is kind of the mistake on the mantis part. They accidentally jumped onto someone's windshield or got spooked and revealed themselves. And that's when we find them. And hopefully the right person finds them, not somebody who is going to swat them or strike them.
Right. Yeah. Standing against a white or red background, probably a bad idea. Probably a mistake for the mantis.
Absolutely.
Do we know how they spend their time? They spend a lot of time standing or sitting or whatever, very, very still. So that they look like a piece of a stem or something like that until some, prey walks by and finds out that they're not. Do we know much of anything else about what they do?
People
don't have hobbies.
No, not unless they just like contemplating. Maybe they're, right, they're quiet hobbies. For the most part, their job is to not be seen. Mm-hmm. And if that means they remain still for hours at a time, then I guess that's their jam.
I have to put you on the spot here, although I mean, perhaps as an entomologist, you're not allowed to get into political questions. But I mean, how do you feel about this idea of dethroning the mantis as our state insect?
It's
It's complicated.
It's complicated. Yeah, thank you. So, you know, we're looking at a state symbol, and generally we want that to reflect our natural ecosystem or geology. And the praying mantis, you know, while it's integrated into that that ecosystem, it wasn't a natural component of it prior to us. And so I can definitely see the appeal of elevating a native species to that position. But then you have the big question, which is, well, what species? And as you can see, we've already got two contenders. And I'm sure there were plenty. I mean, if you let the poll to the public, you know, you'd have people saying honeybee. Well, same problem there. Honeybees are not native to North America either. And then you'd have a lot of entomologists and biologists who would, of course, they've got their favorite that they'd want to elevate. So
do you have a secret favorite that's not a praying mantis?
I mean, I do like dragonflies.
Yeah.
They're just cool.
They are.
They're ancient, and they're just the way they fly.
Yeah.
You know, it's different than modern insects. But it's kind of like a drone, basically.
Yeah.
You know, each of those wings is powered by individual wing muscles, which is kind of the old way of flight for insects. And it's neat, and we can also learn a lot from them as far as how to engineer more efficient machines.
I do want to say, vis-a-vis, I'm just going to sort of say the opposite thing about praying mantises, which is that vis-a-vis this whole idea of what's an indigenous species and what's not. Well, first of all, we are a state of immigrants. You know, I mean, if you're here and you're not Native American, then you're pretty much in the same boat as the praying mantis.
This
right?
is true.
So you can start there anyway. And yes, I mean, you know, and nature isn't static. I mean, we've made it way, way less static and kind of unstable by moving around in ocean ships and airplanes and stuff like that, and things hitch rides and get here. But nature isn't a static thing, and things do migrate, and there used to be land bridges and stuff. So I don't know. I don't know how big a strike that is against the praying mantis.
Yeah, and that's fair.
Yeah.
And there is the Carolina mantis, which is not generally found this far north, but well, the climate's changing, so you know that may change as well.
Well, that maybe brings up the final question of this particular segment, which is, what is climate change likely to do to the praying mantis? Is the praying mantis probably going to be okay in Connecticut if things go up a degree or two? Or
yeah, I mean, as long as there's food for them, they'll do just fine.
that's reassuring.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a little break. We have another thing that we want to tell you about. It's heavily reliant on the work of the evolutionary biologists Zagar and Evans, who did the famous song in the year 2525. What's going to happen a long time from now to animals like the praying mantis? We'll talk about that after this.
Eat the bug.
Yum, yum. Yum, yum. Yum.
Crunch, crunch.
Yum, yum.
All episodes of The Colin McEnroe Show are available 24/7 at ctpublic.org/Colin, which is also where you can sign up for our delightful free fortnightly newsletter, The Nose Letter. You can listen to any episode on any podcast app. Have a question or comment? Email us at colinshow@ctpublic.org. Now, back to the show.
And we are back. Thanks so much, Sabrina. And thanks to Dylan Reyes, the maestro. who was our technical producer today. The senior producer of the Colin McEnroe Show is Lily Tyson. And as you can probably tell, because I've mentioned her about 16 times, she is the producer of this particular episode as well. It has been a terrific visiting with our guest, Catherine Dugas, entomologist and research technician at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. She's going to stay with us here in studio while we do this final segment. She may have some things to say about all this with Liz Alter, professor of evolutionary biology at California State University Monterey Bay, who is one of the people looking at the question of what happens when not just thousands of years, but maybe even a million years go by, what happens to this world? What are some likely scenarios? So, Lisa Alter, welcome to our conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So give us a sense of the actual timescale that you're looking at and thinking about.
Yeah. Well, the farther out in time that we go, what we sometimes think of as sort of deep future, the more speculative, of course, our scenarios become. But, you know, in the horizon of tens of thousands of years, we can make some predictions. We know that, you know, we're currently putting vast pools of carbon dioxide into our atmosphere. And we also know that carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for a really long time before slowly being removed again by natural processes. So, you know, a considerable fraction of what we're emitting now will remain in the atmosphere for tens to hundreds of thousands of years. And that will have fundamental impacts on biogeochemical cycling and biodiversity for thousands of years to come.
By the way, I think I might have said Lisa in the introduction. You're Liz Alter. I'm blaming the eclipse. Everything that I do wrong today is because of the eclipse.
Sounds about right.
It's already starting to mess with my brain. So yeah, let's talk about that carbon. So there's carbon in the atmosphere that makes plants happy, right? Yes. So what do the plants do when they're happy?
Right. So those, you know, gigatons of carbon that we're currently putting into the atmosphere, they're going to stick around for tens of thousands of years, are going to, you know, result in a renaissance of green plants in jungles where there were none before, potentially in areas that are currently, for example, tundra. And that may potentially lead to an atmosphere that's much richer in oxygen than the one that we have now.
And so when that happens, it's so counterintuitive in a way, because we've put so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Obviously, that seems like an imperilment, and it is an imperilment. Mm-hmm. But then, mm-hmm. if you wait long enough, you're going to have to wait longer than our species is going to be alive. But you're going to get oxygen.
Exactly. So we're thinking, you know, hundreds of thousands of years potentially in the future, and we're not talking in calendar years anymore because humans are not on Earth anymore. Let's say we're still in some kind of space pods, just to be optimistic about it. we're not around to be interfering with this renaissance of green plants. So we end up with this increase in atmospheric oxygen that then could, if the past is any guide, have an impact on things like the sizes of insects.
I mean, the sizes of insects are probably also affected by, well, in the case of the praying mantis, the size of insects would also be probably a little bit affected by the things that the praying mantis eats or maybe wants to eat. I would assume it becomes more adaptive for the praying mantis to get bigger if, in fact, other things that it likes are getting bigger.
Yeah, potentially. So it's, you know, with all aspects of animal physiology, we're thinking about trade-offs in terms of metabolism, prey availability, and all that. But you know, one of the interesting physical constraints on insects that's a bit different for insects and vertebrates is how they breathe. So insects breathe not with lungs, but with little tiny tubes called trachea that are found throughout their body that move oxygen from the atmosphere to their cells via these structures called spiracles. And the you might hypothesize or speculate that after insects reach a certain size, they can't get enough oxygen through the trachea because of surface area to volume limitations. So it follows that with a higher concentration of oxygen in the atmosphere, that constraint might be freed up a little bit.
The entomologist in the room is nodding as you speak. Did you want to say something about this?
Great. Okay.
So, and Liz, the great thing about this prediction is nobody's going to come back at you and say, well, that didn't happen. You didn't know what you were talking about.
Right. Yeah, it's fun to speculate when there's not much in the way of consequences.
So this go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that, you know, what we can say is in the past, so, you know, 300 million years ago during the Carboniferous era, when we had about 35% oxygen parts per million as opposed to the 21% that we have now, we did have larger things like dragonflies, which I heard mentioned earlier as a favorite insect, that were more like the size of hawks, and ants that were sometimes the size of, let's say, hamsters. So, you know, larger insects. So it's sort of a fun menagerie to think about.
So, no, I mean, once again, this is not something where you're going to get shouted down later because you were wrong. Yeah. But if you, when you're imagining, I'll say, a larger praying mantis, like what size praying mantis are you imagining?
So I'm imagining, again, super speculative, but I'm imagining, perhaps because I have a similarly sized dog in my home, something around the size of a Cocker Spaniel. Yeah.
All right. I don't know. I'm just wondering, because I do have an entomologist and a praying mantis expert here. What are you thinking as you listen to all this?
I agree.
Yeah.
You know, the main restriction on insect size is amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. And more oxygen in the atmosphere means larger bugs. And again, these things eat anything smaller than them. So, you know, Cocker Spaniel-sized praying mantis, you know, it could be eating gerbils. Or ant-sized gerbils, or gerbil-sized ants.
Gerbil-sized ants, yeah. And what's kind of cool is there's been a little bit of experimental research on this, too, in terms of taking, let's say, species of beetles and putting them in highly oxygenated conditions in the lab and seeing what happens. And certain species can get about 20% bigger in a single generation when given more oxygen. So it does seem to be that there is this physical constraint at the moment that might be released in the future.
Yeah, that makes me want to bet the over here and say, we're going to have Tyrannosaurus Rex-sized praying mantises. And they'll probably look kind of like praying mantises, too. It's a good shape for an animal. We should say this, too, though. I just read somewhere that we are maybe still actually in the Holocene era. It hasn't quite gotten to be Anthropocene yet, but... Liz, we're bad for biodiversity. I mean, one of the aspects of human existence is that the rest of the ecosystems don't really get to do everything that they might ordinarily get to do. Maybe you could say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the sad things about this future scenario is that we won't be necessarily around to be able to see these giant bugs. But yeah, as you know, as we are. As a very young species ourselves, like only 200,000 years old or something, as a species, we have just, you know, fundamentally altered the face of the planet and the biogeochemical cycles in ways that will really stick around for eons. And that's not to say that there won't be many future different eras of the planet. You know, thinking out toward like a billion years when the sun gets so hot that oxygen levels actually drop dramatically. And then we're talking about, you know, really a world in which only microbes have a chance. But in the meantime, you know, the one of the overwhelming kind of double whammies of human existence on the planet is, of course, not just the excessive greenhouse gases we're putting into the atmosphere, but also destroying habitat. And the reason that's a double whammy is because that habitat destruction erodes and reduces genetic diversity of populations that makes them less able to adapt to future conditions. So at the same time we're changing the planet in such a rapid way, we're also reducing the ability of species to be able to have a fighting chance to survive by eroding that genetic variation.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you about the lessons of your research for humankind, but I think you just said it.
It's rather sobering, but at the same time, you know, it's sometimes wonderful to think about the resilience of nature and the fact that, you know, where we have stepped back and let nature flourish and let biodiversity flourish, that it heals very quickly.
All right, we have to stop there. This has been a terrific show. It's been great to visit with both of our wonderful guests today. Scott on social media pointed out that our state motto is qui or qui transtulit sustinet, which means he who transplanted us sustains us. The praying mantis is a transplant, just the way Europeans are too. All right, we're going to say goodbye to you, but thank you very much for listening to our show. Do something nice for a praying mantis and try not to mess up the environment anymore.
Everywhere. Bad bugs. Bad bugs. Fuzzy bugs. Slimy bugs. Creepy crawling bugs. Flying buzzing bugs. Stinging biting bugs. Insects.